When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
My name is Matt, and I'm early 50s now, and sometime back in my 30s, I stumbled across these cool dogs called St. Bernards. I watched a guy named Joe Wolf in the garden with a dog named Ben, and I fell in love with him. I couldn't believe him. He just blew my mind. Now, I now know them. I did their remarriage ceremony for him. Talk about coming full circle. Ben obviously wasn't with us. That was quite a few years ago. But sometime after that, I dabbled in some rescue. I had been working as a paramedic at the time. And I did my MBA later in life. And my mom, bless her heart, said, what do you want, for a graduation present? And I said, I want one of them fancy show dogs. And I got one. I'd picked up a mentor along the way, and he was kind enough to help me source a bitch from a kennel called King's Mill in the Midwest. And I got a smooth bitch, St. Bernard. A smooth bitch. And I learned to show her, and I finished her. Bred her. Bred a litter. Hit a reboot. Saw it more type. And then this guy calls me and says, let's do a podcast. And here we are. Well, when I went into that, like actually breeding them and trying to chase ribbons and showing them, I think honestly the biggest surprise was the networking and politics involved in operating a business that is a functional preservation kennel. That was probably the biggest surprise along the way. When I first started heading down the path, saw the dog, got curious. And I called a local breed club for St. Bernards, and I got somebody on the phone who started talking to me about making a transition, because it was a new world that, I didn't know anything about the fancy of it. All I knew was you get a dog and bring it home and feed it. So I had a guy to steward me along the way, but he didn't quite give me the most comprehensive information, and it kind of stymied my progress a little bit. Got me a good way into it, but not as far as I needed to go. So when I say the politics, I mean I took everything as being gospel, and without meaning to, there was information that was imparted to me that caused me a lot of trouble and stuttering and issues with really getting moving and in breeding dogs and successfully showing them. So the problem was that the way it was presented to me was that everybody except for a very small segment was the enemy. And that kept me from getting a good view of the horizon and really seeing what was out there. It wasn't until I started working with some other groups and got a little bit more exposure that I learned that, okay, look, this is a business and it involves networking and it involves relying on other people and other people's knowledge and certainly keeping your own mind open to the fact that you don't know what you don't know until you realize you don't know it. You might think you know till you hit a wall and realize, yeah, you didn't know. And because I was kept in this kind of narrow confines, I didn't realize that. So when the blinders came off, I kind of banged around like a ball in one of those pinball machines, bing, 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 making all kinds of mistakes. And fortunately, there were some folks that were kind enough to keep some guide rails up for me. And I was able to kind of get through it. But this is a long game. This is not a short game. And relationships matter, because you're going to need some other stock somewhere. You're going to need some information somewhere. You're going to find out you didn't know something and probably should have made friends with somebody when you didn't. And I think if I had come into it with more of a, I don't want to sound cheesy and say kumbaya attitude, but if I'd come into it with more of an understanding that everybody brings something to the table and I should just focus on what's in front of me and what I'm working on, I think I would have made progress more briskly.
For sure. I think that's a story with a lot of people and a lot of different breeds. They get find themselves wrapped up into politics. I mean, I even found myself in this goofy little podcast with some real interesting characters surrounding me like sharks. But and I made some mistakes and I learned from them. So definitely more kumbaya right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I settled into that. And it made it a lot more enjoyable for me because instead of worrying about looking over my shoulder, now I'm just kind of concentrating on my pack and people around me and, you know, just improving the status quo for everybody I come in contact with.
For sure.
Stock that is, these are big giant dogs that were used for farm work and also for, you know, the monks like to keep them around for feeling a little safer. These are big dogs, right? And most people won't mess with them because they've got the big woof woof bark. But you know, they're real good at pulling carts. They're great with any kind of draft. You can use them as plow animals. They're great social animals. And you know, if you bring a bunch of them in the room with you when it's cold out, they'll actually heat the room because they put off a lot of body heat. Mm-hmm. It's mastiffs. Okay, and then they mixed in a Newf. So they started out as being a short haired dog, kind of leggy, not the stocky type of stuff that you see now. And somewhere along the line, they thought they'd look great with long hair. So they mixed in some Newfie and they got some long hair on them. And they sure look pretty with the long hair, but the snow clumps up in it and it would slow them down a bit. So now we have short hairs and we have long hairs. And I guess the American stock now compared to back in the day, this is a lot thicker and beefier than it was. You're talking about more like a mountain looking dog than what you see today. We like them big now.
Can you talk about the official standards of the AKC compared to like the FCI, if you know that?
Drawing the comparisons between them is a little bit difficult for me, but I can tell you that the St. Bernard Club of America is in control of that standard with the AKC, which is kind of nice. So the club gets to write those. Hotly debated topic between them. Between FCI and the American standard, I think there's a couple of things that pop out. One is they've got taller and leggier dogs. We've got some heavier stock, and the standards kind of lean in those directions. Neither of that should detract from the dog. You know, you want something functional, something that can move, something that works. Obviously, we kind of breed to the style that sells where we're exhibiting. But with these guys, you want somebody that's, you don't want a mean dog. They are supposed to be, you know, guard dogs, but by barking, not being real aggressive, you really don't want a giant dog being overly aggressive, and you need to keep that in mind when you're breeding them. Between the two of them, the long hair seems to be much more popular, and I think that's because that's what was marketed heavily in movies. So, you know, when people's subconscious, when they close their eyes and they think St. Bernard, they're thinking of, you know, a shaggy, heavy dog with a mask and a brown and white coat. But honestly, we favor them in the smooth. The roughs just seem to do better in the ring. I think that's the group ring.
How much do they shed?
The smooth shed a lot more than the roughs. There seems to be a whole lot more hair getting put down with them. But they both shed heavily. You know, it's a double-coated dog, so you'll get plenty with both.
All right. And talk about what your experiences in the ring. What has that been like? And how did you get hooked in that environment?
Oh, I think with that, it was just a matter of being competitive. And it's also something you have to do if you're going to exhibit your stock. So, if you want to get out there, if you got a male and you want to get him bred, you kind of have to show him and get somebody impressed enough to come for him. I guess for me, it was kind of part of the, you got to learn how to do this. If you're going to learn how to breed them, you got to learn how to show them. So I went through some classes and learned to do it, made a fool of myself a couple times. Took my first major under a breed judge who said that the dog won despite my best efforts to handicap that.
What are some, when you breed, what standard are you trying to live by? I know you're breeding to the official standard, but what is your ideal St. Bernard? And I'm talking height, weight, and structure, movability, all of that.
So I'm looking for as big and as stocky as I can go without losing balance and movement. I guess they look really cool when they're real stiff, but it causes them a lot of trouble. So I'm going for a headpiece, and I'm just going for big, thick, and can still move. So I'm a real stickler for masks. I really like to see a full mask on a dog, and it tends to color my evaluations heavily. Other than that, it's headpiece, and then body, and again that size and that type. I really look for pushing the envelope without going crazy in it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
From the beginnings of your journey with St. Bernards, how has it things changed for the better, for the worse, and what are some of the differences in styles that are now more popular and are winning ribbons?
So I guess the what I'm chasing is not necessarily what's winning. I'm looking for a bit more excess than is successful in the show ring. I guess what I see successful in the show ring is a machination of ring presence and the dog, not necessarily the type of dog that fits the standard, not necessarily the type of dog that I'm seeking. There's a lot you can say about that. St. Bernards, there's not a lot of them. I think the last time that I was aware of the number of registered litters, it was in the low 400s. Because there's not that many, when win the ring, there's a handful of dogs. In fact, okay, for example, this coming weekend up here in New England is their working dog series, and I'm excited. There's a big entry. There's 15 dogs, 15 St. Bernards entered. Three of them are specials. So there's not a lot of them. So I think it's really interesting to watch the all breed judging when it comes to St. Bernards. It really is. And I don't say that to try to cast any disparaging observations. It's really interesting. It seems more like in the specialty circuit, there's some more consistency.
What do you think would help that, just by more education with the judges, or
Well,
is it something that the breed club is falling short on
no,
with
I
the
don't think it's under
education?
the control of the breed. So, there's a couple of parts of this. Okay, sure, there's education. Okay, so there's breeder education, but then there's also when we have been fortunate enough in the breed to have somebody that really put time and money into campaigning a typey or a proper Saint Bernard, it helped across the entire spectrum of all breed entries. When there's not, and it's patchwork, it's going to be what's in the ring at the time. What is the larger portion of the population in the ring look like? And then that seems to be what's getting the nod. Even if the outlier dog in the ring is the one that should be pointed to for closely relating to the standard, it looks funny. So it just depends on the populations, and it depends on what's going on out there. So, we haven't had in a couple of years, we haven't had somebody out really pushing a dog. We do now. We've got a fella out there now. I'll go ahead and throw him a bone. There's a guy out there named Monty. Marty Glover's got him out. He's a nice big dog. And hopefully catches some attention and maybe helps recalibrate things a little bit. When we don't have that, and then before that, it was, gosh, it was a couple years before that when there was another big player that had a dog out with a really talented handler that was hitting the circuit heavily, and influencing the eyes. I suspect that's common.
Yeah, it is coming from all the research that I've done. So that's what I've come to understand. Do you show your own dogs, or
I do. And I've been fortunate enough to have one of the folks that I sold a puppy to stayed close, came in real close and mentored and learned a bunch. And now she's past me. She's way better in the ring than I am. So I do some of my own, and then I get help from friends and so on and so forth.
Talk about the trials and tribulations of being an owner, breeder, handler.
Well, I get out handled a lot. It's not my profession. So even with diligent practice, it's difficult for me to compete with professional handlers. I mean, let's face it, they're doing this day in and day out. And then I think they have a competitive advantage when they handle other breeds. I'm only doing St. Bernard. So, I'm bringing out my stuff and I'm grooming my dog and I'm showing my dog and, I'm doing the best I can, but it's difficult to keep up with. And I don't say that in a disparaging way. That's their craft. They're supposed to be better at it than I am. So, that, and I guess, so let's see, what else? Well, the COVID restrictions were very difficult and seemed to kind of recalibrate things. But I guess right now the biggest obstacle, and not to sound whiny about it, but gas is awful expensive. It's expensive to eat out when you go out. So it seems like it raised the price of doing everything that's going out and showing dogs.
Yeah, I'm somebody who's really, really interested in this world. I'm fascinated by it. I've never been to a dog show. I plan on doing it probably this year when things warm up.
You haven't.
I want to be around other dog folks and see other breeds and learn from people and talk to people. But there are a few things that hold me back from getting serious about it. And one of those things is the cost. And the other is kind of the stuff shirt. I'm anti-elitist 100%, and that's my bias. Mm. I see somebody in a suit that looks like they have a stick up. You know what? Mm-hmm. I tend to back off and get kind of, I don't know, lack of a better word, street. You know what I mean? I don't. It doesn't interest me. It becomes more of a what I would consider a popularity contest instead of showing off.
I can see that. That's just my perception. I can see that.
And there's a lot of people that I talk to that I truly believe are in it for the dogs and in it for the right purposes.
I can see
and
that.
The original purposes. So.
I think of that as a uniform, though. I think of that suit as like a uniform. Like, so the sport harkens back to highbrow philosophy. This is not a sport for the faint heart. Dogs is horses for poor people, right? So there's supposed to be a reverence and a respect and an order of precedent to this sort of thing. And I think that the attire is merely showing the mutual respect to the judge, who's also in attire, and I don't think of it as any more than a uniform. If in fairness with St. Bernards, you can't keep anything clean more than about 30 seconds, because I'm gonna have you drool on my shoulder and hair everywhere, and,
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, and I can appreciate that. The only thing that for me now would be, I could get over that, but for me, it's then it comes down to the cost. Mm. And I agree with you that dogs are the poor man's horses, for show.
Yep.
The show purposes.
Yep.
and livestock, you know what I mean?
Yep.
It was born out of the working class roots. And so that's near and dear to my heart, is because I come from working class roots. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what I see now is it's the working class are just kind of like phased out of it.
It's tough.
It doesn't seem like that there's a lot of new blood coming in, that it's generational and it's, you're born into it. And,
yep.
And so somebody like you, you know, you got an uphill battle of,
yep.
You but know, you're, maybe you're not, an outsider.
Maybe not though, because, so coming in, I came in as an adult. I started in my 40s and I'm now 53. The folks that I know that are generational, that are my age, are fighting the image of being at the kids' table because they grew up in this and they were running around in diapers and hoop skirts and stuff like that. And I watched the dynamic between the senior members of the fancy and those, and they treat them worse than they treat me because they treat them like children and they don't do that to me. So that generational thing's a gift and a curse.
What do you think would change people's perception, and what would help the show community in getting more people like myself, or, you know, that come from that kind of background to come into the ring and use it as a tool for their breeding programs?
You know, I sat in the boardroom of the St. Bernard Club of America talking about this. There were some ideas. I don't have the answer, but I'll tell you what some of the ideas were. One was the reach across the aisle to the sport folks, the post title folks that got into this. I got in because I was at a dog show and I took my rescue and I put a CGC on her. Lady said, oh, have you practiced for this? No, I didn't practice. What do you need to do? She showed me the list. I said, we could do it. I did it. I think, and I was encouraged along the way. And I think, you know, I mean, I think everybody kind of does this, right? You know, if you see somebody around, you kind of try to throw your arms around them and you try to bring them in. And I don't know. I don't know that there's necessarily a fix for this because, I mean, let's be honest, we are in competition with each other. So it's not always going to be hug, hug, kiss, kiss, because I want to beat you. I want to take the ribbons home. So I don't know. I guess I think anybody that's doing this needs to take a good close look at their dog. If they like what they see and they want them to keep being around, they need to bring people in to be preservation breeders. And they probably need to do that with an understanding that not everybody you bring in is going to work out. You're going to bring in a lot of folks that are going to come in and peter out. You're going to bring in people that are going to try to game the system and try to puppy mill because they think you can make a ton of money doing this. You're going to bring in all kinds of stuff. But if you can bring in a superstar or two, then you did it. So if somebody helped you out, try to pay it forward, you know, find your people and try to spread some love. There's that crunchy stuff again. But, you know, like, look, a guy took a chance on me when I called the Northern New Jersey St. Bernard Club back in, like, it was 90 or 91, okay? And I called him up. It was 2000. Called him up, just asking questions. I was living in North Carolina at the time, and I was like, hey, dude, I just saw this dog in the garden. Freaking gorgeous. I want to get there. How do I do that? So be that person that takes that call and take some interest in that person and help them along. Somebody did it for me. I did it for somebody else. And that person managed to put more titles on that. I bred a dog. I sold a dog to a young lady, despite the fact that a mentor was telling me I was crazy for doing it. And she put more titles on that dog than any St. Bernard in history. And I'm not talking just on the front, on the back. So it's rally advanced. It's dock diving. She's got his grand champion bronze. He's in the Hall of Fame, Plateau of Excellence. So I would say, take a chance on somebody did it for you, pay it forward, and try to have a good time.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's it doesn't always have to be selfless, you know what I mean? If you have somebody that has the fire in them and you take the chance, that actually could help you out in the long run. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it did. She helped me showing my dog. That's from the top 20. She did that with the dog from my first breeding. Oh yeah, and then these are from pre-shows at the National. She handled the dog, a dog that's out in the backyard at the National. Got me a winner's dog, at a pre-show from Breeder Judge. I needed a little help. I was having a little bit of trouble moving around, and I needed somebody to go in there and do it. She did it. So yeah, I would say invest in that. It pays off in dividends.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's definitely a selfish tinge to being selfless. You know what I mean? I think that we kind of lose sight of that.
Put out what you want back, you know, like,
yeah, yeah.
It gets hard though, because I got to be honest, like, you know, I get into this thing, right? And I'm like, I don't understand the animus. How come there's people fighting with each other? I don't get it, how people couldn't get along. And here I am. All right, I joined the St. Bernard Club of America in 2012. And I've got people that they don't want anything to do with me. It's all right. I get it. I stepped on their toes. I made a lot of friends along the way too. But I get that about the animus thing now. We're all in competition with each other. Sometimes it gets heated.
Yeah, competition is a good thing because in some ways, because it, if done in a proper way, it fuels things like good dogs. If you're talking about, you know, in the show ring,
yeah,
it's, you know, it has that potential to do that if people really have the malice of forethought and like, okay, that's, I gotta reach to that standard. I gotta really pay attention to how I'm breeding my dogs and what I'm gonna go next.
Yeah.
And it goes in other lives, like, you know, like sports, you know, yeah, you, or say martial arts. You really want to get good at martial arts. You're going to have to practice,
get into the competition. You're going to get your butt kicked if you don't, kind of like the dogs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to get into the ring. If you know, a lot of martial arts says this is too violent for sport. Well, stay away from those martial arts because they're not proving themselves in competition.
Yeah,
the martial arts that work are the ones that go in and compete. Your boxings, your wrestlings, yeah, your judos, and yeah, now your Brazilian jiu-jitsus. They train every day for a competition. They can translate that, what they learn in the competition, straight into this in self-defense street,
yeah,
way quicker than a guy that took karate and all he did was shadow box for 20 years.
That's so true.
That's kind of how I see the show ring is, you know, you're breeding and you're showing the movement that's correct and all of that. But I think some of the ideas and some of the politics and the ideas of what's preservation, then that's where where it gets a little muddy, I think, sometimes.
It does. And I would say you don't necessarily have to get caught in that undertow, right? So if you want to just get in and do your thing and you don't want to, you know, muck around and you don't want to rock the boat too hard, you can do that. But I think a lot of the people that do get into it, that they do want to rock the boat because they want to be competitive. And I think you really only need martial arts in the group ring.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, it's probably friendlier when you're, yeah, I get it. Especially with the breed that doesn't have as many specimens out there, I bet.
Oh yeah.
You all know each other probably pretty well.
It's hard to go to a show and not know the other entrance with St. Bernard's. Like, there's only so many of them. So yeah, like, so there's 15, I want to say it's three dogs, eight bitches, three special dogs, right? Did I get that right? Is that, yeah, that counts, right? And then on Sunday, there's one extra dog. And I can pretty much guarantee I know who's going to be there. That's okay.
Talk about what, what are some of the differences of today show St. Bernard to yesterday, and say in 1999 when you were looking?
Well, I didn't set foot in the ring until 2013 because I was in rescue in North Carolina and all that stuff before that. But let's see, then and now? I mean, the entry fees are up about $3. I don't think there's much difference, really. At least not that I'm aware of. I guess on the grand stage of the country, there's a difference because, and I talked about this earlier, we don't have somebody out dropping $250,000 a year on promoting a Saint Bernard on the circuit. So when you go to the all breed shows, it's more localized. When you have somebody that's putting that kind of effort into it and putting a dog all over the country, you'll find more standardization, and you'll find the all breed judges leaning more towards the qualities that you see in that dog that's getting campaigned. Now, I guess the only thing you can really do is rely on print for that. People memory hole awful fast. I mean, something that happened 2 weeks ago is gone. So I think that influences it. Yeah, you know what? I will say that. I'd say that's what it is that influences it, because now it seems like the nod is going more towards the aggregate. You know, like, so what's the general population in the ring look like? And then what's the best of that general population? I also talked about this earlier. That's not necessarily the proper type, it's just what's there.
In a lot of breeds, especially dogs that are considered working dogs or have had some sort of like serious type job in the past, there's a division between show lines and working lines. Is that the case in Saint Bernards, or is it all just pretty much intermingled?
So we have, okay, so working dog for Saint Bernards is weight pull and drafting. And I think our weight pull champions are also confirmation dogs, at least in the near past that I can recall. Yes, sure, there would be people that would be competing in those events that were not confirmation dogs, but our confirmation dogs were doing it just fine. The other thing that's picked up lately is this fast cat has become very popular, which that's not something that I think of associating a Saint Bernard with. They don't do anything fast. Maybe fall asleep fast. And that obviously those dogs that would excel in fast cat, that wouldn't be the type of dog that I would be looking to breed or feed.
Why is that?
Well, fast cat, you're talking about a sprint. You're talking about getting out and moving fast. That's not what a working dog is supposed to do. You need the endurance, you need the power. So I'm not looking for a four-cylinder supercharged turbo Subaru. I want that V10 monster truck.
Right. I mean, these breeds are have been bred for a purpose, and sometimes the purpose is different. I think a lot of people lose sight of that. We all don't want border collies or American pit bull terriers. We want our big livestock guardian dog, or your Saint Bernard that's gonna
Also
pull
think you
that kit out of the snow or whatever.
I also think you might find that somebody's going to look at them differently, whether they're breeding them or whether they're showing them, because the dog that's going to win frequently in the show ring, not necessarily the dog you want in your breeding program. We all kind of chase different things. Yeah, there's no such thing as a dry mouth Saint Bernard. If somebody says there's a dry mouth in their breeding program, run, run, run from it. Well, see, I think people only know what they're told, right? So some of those myths are just because they were told, and some people might believe something that's incorrect, and it's not necessarily a nefarious thing that they're doing by believing it. They just think it because it's what they were told. Like, what are some myths in the Saint Bernard world? Yeah, not seizures and epilepsy, very different things. Very different things. OFA on a puppy that's a year old, and that dog's going to change a lot. Maybe, it's, what else? Gosh. What else? Oh, and kelp, don't go crazy with the kelp. Yeah, there's my top three. The famous historical St. Bernard's name is Barry. He's unimpressive looking. He's a brown and white dog that you might not recognize as looking like a St. Bernard of today, but I can't think of any mysterious anything. There's the whole thing with the keg, take it or leave it, whether it was there or not. It's fun. Everybody's accepted it. Just go with it. Just don't let them wear it when they're running around because it'll bang them in the chest and hurt them.
And have you looked at the dogs of that era and the standard back then? And
well, sure.
What's the biggest
change? You can see how it's evolved, but I guess the first thing that comes to mind in terms of real big change is that, you know, now we can ship semen all over the place. And now we have the internet. And now we have movies. And you can see these dogs. You don't necessarily have to go see them. And I'm sure it doesn't take a stretch of the imagination to understand the implications of what it would do for the breeding population if you didn't have to worry about using a dog from California because you could FedEx semen. By comparison to, you know, if we went back to before that was popular, you'd have to drive out there and time it and hope for the best. You stress the bitch on the way back. I mean, it just changes everything, right? So, I guess that's probably the thing that comes to mind as being the most impactful is the advent of technology in our lives. Obviously, it would affect the breeding programs as well.
Have you seen a lot of poor moving St. Bernards lately?
So, I know that in the quest for height, because everybody's looking for a tall and impressive St. Bernard, when you stretch the limbs, you straighten the angles. So, you know, you see a lot of straight fronts and straight rears and people trying to achieve taller dogs. But I don't know if that's any different than any other breed. I would think the same thing would happen, because as you stretch, you pull the angles out.
What is the standard for height and weight?
25 inches for a bitch and 27 inches for a male. And it depends on whether you're in America or whether it's FCI, is whether there's a height limit. You're generally going to see those dogs in that 27 to 31, and you're going to see those bitches in the 25 to 28. As far as their weight, gosh. I spoke earlier about bone and mass and type in these guys. And as you can imagine, you could take a dog that's 31 inches. If you change the bones and the limbs from that to that, obviously they're going to be a lot heavier. So I had a 28 inch bitch that weighed about 165 pounds. I got a 31 inch dog outside that's probably around 200 pounds. But it's not like we're seeking any particular weight in general. We're looking for balance, right? So you want them to be tall enough that they look powerful and imposing. And if they're too short, they don't. If they're too short in leg, they don't. If their legs are too small, they don't. They don't hit that. So you're going for that without going over the edge. And I think for a lot of us, we're trying to really get on the top of that fence there with that, you know, like get as far up into the type as you can without teetering over the edge. We've had a couple that have teetered over the edge.
What are some health concerns with the modern St. Bernard that the Breed Club is trying to educate their members about?
Sure. So there's a couple things out that you're going to hear frequently about these big, big dogs. One of them's going to be bloat. All right. We also got, you know, joint issues, hips and elbows, right? Because again, you're going real tall and extreme. The eyes that are too loose. There's only a couple of those things that are like death sentences, right? Some of them you can really live with, because you can be kind of loose in the hips if the musculature holds them in place, the dog does it right. But obviously bloat can take them out pretty quick. And I got all kinds of speculation on that. Grain diet, whatever, seems to run in lines, you know, high stress dogs and stuff like that. Osteosarcoma, that's around two. But I don't want to sit there and give the impression that that's prevalent or that it's all over the place or that every St. Bernard has it, because that's not how it is. It's there, But it's not like every single one of them's got it, at least not in my experience.
What does health testing mean to you and your program?
Health test. It's interesting you ask that. So I spent the early part of my career as a paramedic. And I didn't just stop there. I went in and did OR tech and I did cath lab tech. So I had a bunch of advanced education. I taught advanced cardiac life support, pediatric advanced life support, trauma life support. I taught doctors. I taught nurses. I guess where I'm going with that is that I guess I'm a bit of a medical geek. And also paramedic didn't pay a whole lot of money. So I went and I worked with a little hospital called Animal Medical for a while as a vet tech. And I didn't get certified in it because I already knew how to do all the stuff they wanted me to do. But so around the health stuff, been on the health panel for the St. Bernard Club of America, been on the board for the St. Bernard Club of America. And health testing, I think, is completely valid. I think it's a great thing to do. I think it's a great tool to have in the arsenal of considering the health of a breeding program and your dog. But I think it's important not to get too zoned in on any one thing. Health testing's great. Genealogy is important. You know, what's in the line? What's going on with these litters? How, you know, trace them back and pay attention to what you're doing. It's fine and dandy to health test them now, but wouldn't you want to know if it was there? Because honestly, these health tests, and I'm not trying to get on a soapbox and sound negative about them, but the only health test that is absolutely bona fide is one that can give you an absolute result, and that's a genetic test, and that's usually done with a swab. And in St. Bernard's, I think DM is the only thing that we have a swab for. If you take them out for orthopedic testing, that's great. That's subjective. You know, the position when they're x-rayed, the read of the x-ray. I'm not invalidating the test. Don't get excited. I'm not saying it's garbage. I'm just saying it's all subjective. And I think sometimes the testing is used as a bit of a virtue signal against kennels that are relying more heavily on genealogy, because, you know, the genealogy is valid. You know, we just talked about bloat. If a dog bloats and there's bloat in the line, don't breed them. You don't have a test for bloat. So I think that's the whole thing with testing. I think it's important that, you know, you take the whole picture into account, not just get into one particular population or one particular theory. Pay attention to all of it. Talk to everybody. Talk to as many breeders as you can, as many vets as you can, and try to learn something, because there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there. How's the dog move? If the dog moves great and you look at the x-ray and the x-ray doesn't look good, I would start asking questions. I mean, so, you know, one of the things that that they taught us when we were using medical equipment and doing diagnostics was you don't just look at one thing. You know, if I put an EKG machine on you and it shows a flat line and you're sitting there talking to me, obviously you're not in asystole. Obviously there's something wrong with the equipment. Well, when it comes to these tests, and I'm leaning more on the orthopedic side of things, use it subjectively. You know, like the hips show that the ball is not firmly seated in the socket, but yet when you watch the dog ambulate, the dog moves just fine and the dog stands there just fine and you can move the leg around just fine and there's no pain. Well, maybe when they took the x-ray, the person that took the x-ray hyperextended the limb and that's why it's a little popped out. I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying take it all with a grain of salt. Use the tools. I'm not saying throw them out, but use it with a grain of salt and look at the big picture with it, you know? So, except for something that's conclusive. If you do a DM swab and the dog has the genetic marker for DM, you know the dog's got DM. They don't have to be falling on the floor. You know the DM marker's there. It'd be nice to get more subjective tests out there, or more genetic tests, you know, finite testing.
What would that look like for like x-rays and stuff for hips and joints? And
well, I think what you do is you would look for a marker. You'd have to have a sufficient population to show a consistent result in a particular marker. So like, for example, so let's say you're doing brown eyes. Okay. So you say, okay, this dog has this chromosome, it matches, the eyes are brown. If I breed it to another one that has this marker, I'm going to have brown eyes. All right, that's the simple way to do it. The harder way is when you get into the medical anomalies and it's not something that you can subjectively look at. So then you'd have to test the population and you'd have to get results. And the only way that's going to happen is if people really buy into testing and the testing expands and you have a larger population, because the larger the population of the test, the higher the accuracy of the results, right?
Maybe part of the problem too is some of these results are hidden because of the fear of the backlash.
Well, I mean, that's relevant, man. I mean, you know, like, look, if you've got something in your program and you're scared to say it because you think everybody's going to crap on you, that ruins it. I mean, I don't think you could possibly breed without at some point or another running into something, right? So it's not an if, it's a when. Kind of like if you ride a motorcycle, it's not if you fall. When are you going to fall? You're going down on that bike. It's just a matter of when. Well, it's the same thing with the breeding program. You're going to have a problem, but you have to have an environment where you can say, hey, you know, I just had this litter and these guys were 8 weeks out and three of them are shaken. Do I have epilepsy? You'd be able to talk to people because you'd want to go back and trace your lines and see if that was prevalent in other lines before and so on and so forth. But now, you know, people want to hide it and they want to say, oh, get this out of here. Otherwise, I'm going to get a reputation. So, I mean, we need to love one another. We need to learn to lead with love and, you know, leave it in the ring, compete in the ring, leave it in the ring and don't hate outside the ring.
It was a lady, a veterinarian who owns Dobermans, and she shows them, and then she also competes with them in protection sports. So she really mm-hmm. wants a high, mm-hmm. high capacity type mm-hmm. dog, mm-hmm. functional and everything. And she was really concerned. And as a veterinarian, she had been known for being a Doberman vet. And so a lot of Doberman owners and breeders would come to her. So she saw a lot of specimens and had a lot of hands on. So she wanted to reach out to somebody, a canine geneticist, and to do some research. Mm-hmm. Well, what I found with this podcast, for one, canine geneticists are pretty hard to come by these days.
Yeah. There's not a lot of money. There's
not many of them out there. And like you said, not a lot of money into it. So anyway, she found a lady from, I think it was Australia, and they got as many specimens as possible to be tested through Embark. And some of the precursor information they came up with was really interesting. I'll have to re-listen to it again because I'm not smart enough to get it all in one scoop. But kind of the gist was, the more the problems they saw were from the dogs that were specifically bred to show lines mm-hmm. and dogs that were specifically bred for working lines. Mm. They had the most problems.
I can posit.
And the ones that had the least amount of problems mm-hmm. were the dogs that were born for just pet quality. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. she was saying it's time for both of these lines, and then they're separated. That's kind of why I asked you about the mm-hmm. differences between mm-hmm. European and American or whatever. Mm-hmm. There is a definite difference between European and American lines as far as Dobermans. I mean, their standards, the FCA, it's quite a bit different.
If the DNA hasn't crossed the ocean, it's a completely separate line.
And that's part of the issue, too, that's been going on in Europe. Mm-hmm. They've been seeing the same problems. Mm-hmm. We in the United States are able to get their blood, mm-hmm. and so we're seeing their problems. Mm-hmm. So anyway, she was saying that what needs to happen is these pet breeders need to, or these show and working breeders need to go to these pet breeders to infuse some of their blood.
No, thanks.
She said,
No, thank you.
Mm-mm. Right. She said, Her information was that this added at least 2 to 3 years of healthy life and lessened the major problems like DM mm-hmm. and the other issue.
I'm sure.
Dramatically.
I'm sure. It also set the, it would set your breeding program back decades. Oh, was I supposed to run with that? So I'm going to hypothesize or posit, as I said, when we're looking to typify, we tend to inbreed. And when we inbreed, we can lock in traits. When we lock in traits, we lock in the good. We also lock in the bad. And they'll talk about how you can line breed for so long and then you have to outcross. And what that doctor's saying is literally like, yeah, man, you need to outcross. Yeah, but the problem with outcross like that is that everything that you've built in your line breeding program is now going to be diluted and watered down unpredictably by the pet breeders. Because when we outcross to another line breed. So you got line breed, 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 two different lines, but we weave them together because this one is stable and this one is stable. It's predictable. What she's saying is, go to John Q. Amish guy and grab his purebred dog, throw all that DNA into yours. No, you'd lose all your predictability of just about everything, including health. Because remember earlier when I was saying the testing is great, use it in conjunction with consideration of your breed lines. That is to say, like, you know, were grandma and grandpa, did they have it? Did grandpa, great, you know, great, 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 all the way back, did they have it? Did they have it? Did they have it? Well, now, once you've done that outcross, so that absolutely you don't know what it is, you've lost half of that table of information. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I would have a hard time as well. But it's interesting, and it gets you thinking. And what was also interesting was the German club that was extremely strict about letting outside blood in has changed their mind just the beginning of this year. In January. So that's kind of interesting. And what was kind of interesting to me was that I hear a lot of like, oh, the working line is so much healthier. The working line. Well, I look at the working lines of dogs and I say, well, yeah, they're more impressive. And I might be visually geared towards more of a working German Shepherd than I am a show line German Shepherd. Or a working line Cane Corso to a show line Cane Corso.
When you say working line to me, that sounds like I don't want to say mutt, but I mean, it sounds like somebody who's not able to achieve in like an AKC program. Is that, oh, look, it's giving me thumbs down stuff. Did I do that? Did it do that? How did it do that?
I don't know. It just, if it detects.
Anyway, because I mean, like, we have this, there's AKC and then there's CKC or something like that. And you'll get those people that'll say, oh, mine is better. No, yours is better. They're different. It's kind of like Android and iPhone. But for some reason, when you say working lines to me, it sounds like they can't get in the show ring and compete. Is that accurate?
They breed to a different standard. That's all. They don't want to compete in the show ring at all. They look at the show ring as a joke. You take somebody like the big thing with Cane Corsos, that, you know, they're a popular breed.
Yeah, dogs. Yeah, yeah. Those things were on Game of Thrones. They ate. That was cool. Yeah.
So one of the things is the guys that do a lot of your protection work and your other kind of sports will say, I can't bring my dog, even if he is correct and fits the standard, into that ring because he won't let a judge touch him.
Oh, so they're not breeding the temperament as prescribed by the breed club either.
No, they're going after more of a rustic type. Like, you know, for example, your Staffordshire Bull Terriers.
Woe to the person that breeds a St. Bernard like that, because I'd like to see them try to contain it. Because a Cane compared to a St. Bernard, those are little by comparison, man. I would hate to see somebody breed a Saint Bernard like that. Oh, wait, they did. They called the movie Cujo. How'd that go?
Well, I think I don't think the Saint Bernard, I don't think that's built into their temper. They're there to be a gentle guardian.
Hopefully.
You know what I mean? And I think that the original, they've just been around so long. Now with something like the Conde Corso, who hasn't been around that long, you know, you get certain people who are breeding to certain standards or whatever. So there's a lot of, and then you look at a working line, say German Shepherd on the show line, German Shepherd. Mm-hmm. Working line is definitely shorter hair. The angulation is correct. The top line is correct.
They're breeding for different stuff. Yeah, I get what you're saying.
That's all
they're making a custom. Based. That's kind of like if you take your van out and you haven't put an interior in it and the windows, and now it's a conversion van.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I know somebody. Yeah, I know somebody that does that with shepherds out in California.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it visually, I think sometimes these dogs would fit what my ideal standard would be as far as a certain dogs, but that's certain breeds.
Mm-hmm, you know what
I mean? I look at a Neapolitan Mastiff and I say, if it's looking more like a Conde Corso, then that's a Conde Corso.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I want a Neapolitan to look like a Neapolitan, but I also want it to be functional.
So the preservation to show in me is twitching at this concept because the whole mission here is to try to maintain that standard. Like I'm trying to maintain that standard, not define the behavior to some other standard that I've made up in my head, not redefine the dog's traits based on I like it that way. I'm trying to do the concept of the time-honored tradition thing that is, this is a work of art that people have endeavored to maintain and has grown through people's love and admiration through the years. And I would almost feel like anything done to it beyond that would be perverting it. And I don't say that to try to take away from the people that you're describing, because what they're doing is fine. People customize cars all the time. I mean, there's a huge market for it. But I guess for me personally, I feel like I'm trying to maintain that tradition. Oh, and that goes right to that whole suit thing we were talking about earlier, right? Like, I'm trying to keep something going, preserve it, you know, like in the name of or something like that. Not that I feel like somebody who's not is doing something bad, just that's my thing.
When does it stop being preservation and then it just becomes breeding to just a standard instead of actually preserving the breed?
Preservation is breeding to the standard. I'm trying to preserve that standard. And I guess, who's making the decision that something needs to be fixed? Because if you look at, and St. Bernard's a great example, because these guys have been around for a while. It's not like they just showed up in the 70s. They've been around for a long time. And they have evolved through that period of time. They've evolved by people who are trying to maintain that standard. And I know, like, when they sit down and they write the standard, they'll literally sit and debate each and every word within the standard to weigh that word and what it means, because words cast spells. When you talk, you're imparting information to another person. You're giving them an impression. And when we talk about the standard of the St. Bernard, we're trying to use words to create a visual image so that you can create this dog that is powerful and imposing and stern but not ill-natured and all these, you know, specific things. So I guess, who would I be to come along and decide that something needed to be changed? So I don't think I would try to change it. My grandmother made an apple pie, right? She gave the recipe to my mom, and I liked that pie, and I liked it when I went to grandma's house, and when I went to mom's house it tasted the same. And then I tried to teach my first wife how to make that pie, and she couldn't. Anyway, so I guess, and so with the dogs, we're trying to maintain this, you know, we're trying to maintain that or preserve that standard, not change it to suit our needs. Now, I can understand why, if you were going to use that dog in a protective capacity and you needed to respond a certain way to certain stimulus, that would be changing it, but you're not changing the standard. You're just creating a model. Like you're adding nitrous to your Mustang. Depending on who you ask, they'll tell you different lines are better than other lines. And that seems to be in the eye of the beholder as well. So I guess it's what do you want, right? I mean, what is it that you're looking for? And I think that kind of develops with time too, because I'll say like there's a type and a style, and there's definitely an eye for that, because you know, like some guys like a Camaro, some guys like a Mustang. The line's a little different. Same thing with this.
Concept that I have a hard time with is when I look at, take French Bulldogs for example, or English Bulldogs, what I've owned most of my life. The dogs that I've always been geared toward is that wow factor at the end of the leash. It could
What
be,
is that wow factor? What gives the wow factor for you guys?
well, for me in particular, it's a little different than some, because I've had with the English Bulldogs in particular, is I like an English Bulldog that looks athletic but thick, that has good movement but isn't overweight, you know what I mean? That has a little extra sharpness in their drive. But not overly, it's still friendly and everything, but I want thick, and that if I lose a little height, I don't care.
You'll trade that.
If I have to lose a couple pounds, I don't care. If he's got the muscle and the bone, I like, and the skin's tighter, not a lot of loose skin. That's what I like. That's out of standard in a lot of ways. With what I'm noticing with, but then take that all back. If I'm looking at like an old English Bulldog or even some English Bulldogs, if I get a big bruiser with a big head and he looks intimidating and he looks correct and every, you know, his structure looks good, but he may, maybe he's not, doesn't move as well as that athletic one that I liked. I like that, right? He looks the part. So I saw some people that before old English Bulldogs were really a thing, some of those dogs are extremely impressive because they weren't living by some sort of breed standard. They were living by what they visually wanted and what they wanted out of the temperament. Man, they were impressive dogs. It was an impressive dog on a leash. Now I see some of these dogs at the end of the leash, and I'm saying, well, okay, they all
Ain't
look
doing it.
alike.
Ain't doing
They
it.
all look alike. Like you get into a Doberman specialty and you see they all look the same. How, as a naked eye, as somebody who's a layman, right? You would have to really know that breed to tell the difference. You'd really have to understand the minutia of that breed to really tell the difference. So that's where I kind of, I get hesitant to get deep into what I would consider preservation or breed club, because when I do look at a Saint Bernard, I want that impressive big head. I want that, but then I also want that lovey-dovey dog that's gonna come up to you and sit next to you and want pets, right?
It's stern but not ill-natured. So like you know, like he should look at you and you should be comfortable and feel safe, but you should look at him and know, like, you know what, this dude could tear me up if he needed to, but I don't think he will. But like, you know what I mean? Like you want that stern but not ill-natured. So they're like they kind of like they look through you and they've got this mellow happiness, not a goofy thing. You know what I mean? Like it's got to be alert, paying attention, and upstanding. I like that ring presence when they know they're the best thing in there.
Yeah, I mean that you just genetic wise, you talk about the predictability. That I see why that's so important.
It can cost you a fortune not to have it. Well, if you don't have it and you don't have the predictability, your program is nowhere. So you would have the added expense of the medical ex cost of the dog itself, but then it's also going to impact your future and your breeding program, because now all the puppies downstream for generation, 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 or worse, now you've just backed yourself into a corner and you have to start over again.
Yeah, I was talking about that wow factor.
Oh yeah.
And that kind of seems like what you're trying to do, but you know, within the confines of
well, I'm trying to breed a national specialty winner. It's just that's exceedingly hard to do.
Just lack of specimens and just
it takes time and it just pops. I mean, like, you know, every time I've done a breeding, I had a vision of what I was trying to get to, and I got some really cool stuff, but then it wasn't quite what I was looking for. And it seems like by the time it came around, I wanted more anyway. I always want more.
What is the Nationalist Breed Club winner? What does he have compared to the rest right now?
This year's national specialty winner was a fella named Enzo, bred by a fairly new breeder. And he sold that dog. I don't think he expected it to win the national when he sold it. What does that dog have that others don't? I mean, we could sit here and have the debate, and if there were other St. Bernard people here, they'd have the debate about whether that was the dog that should win. But I would say what that dog had was, aside from an exceptional profile and a very flashy coat and really meeting the standard, it was big and typey beyond a lot of the other specimens in the ring. And when I say typey, I mean like it had the most exaggerated elements of our standard in all of the right places. Not exaggerated to a clown factor, just exaggerated to a it's there factor. So like St. Bernard's a head breed. When you look at the dog, you better be like, oh my God, that head. Otherwise, it's not there. You know, when you look at the dog, like the size of the dog, you better look at the dog and be like, oh my God, that thing is massive. Otherwise, it's just not there. And then when it gets out and moves, it's got to take your breath away. It's got to just look like music and art, and everything's got to land right and move right and flow right. And I mean, once you see it, you know it's there. It's hard to get there. There's always like a little something missing.
So when you look at your program in 2013 to now, what has changed in your vision?
I did a complete reboot. I started out with a great bitch. She was missing some stuff. She had some angulation issues. But there were a lot of cool parts that were there. And I bred her late and I didn't breed her enough. And when I say that, I mean, I hesitated on breeding her, and then I only got one litter out of her, three puppies. I should have done a couple of them to get some more out of there. The litter that I had was three boys. It didn't yield what I needed to. So I did a reboot. I went and I got another bitch, similar lines. And I started over again. To kind of jumpstart that process, because if I had to work forward with what I had, it would have taken more steps than if I just jumpstarted with a better bitch. So I leased a bitch and I made a deal and moved it ahead.
And where do you see your program in, say, 5 years? What are some of your goals?
Oh, so 10 dogs, 10 St. Bernards, not necessarily dogs or bitches. I'd like to get heavier into bitches. The good Lord blessed me with some really nice males, but I endeavored for a bitch kennel. So I'd like some more bitches. And what'll happen is I'll go get some more, I'll breed some more, and I'll keep going. In what direction? I mean, I've got a nice trajectory going. I want to keep going with, typey stock that meets the standard, maybe a little bit excessive on the standard.
So you really believe kind of your goal is more of a heavy on the female dogs instead of your studs, huh?
Yeah.
Has your philosophy changed on that, or has that always been your
no
your
I started
philosophy?
Out wanting bitches, and that's probably why I had all dogs. So there's the age-old question, right? So you have a litter, pick one, pick two, pick three dogs, pick four a bitch. Do you keep the bitch or do you keep the dogs? I kept a bitch. I don't like her. I kept the dog. I really like him. So it's just they keep giving this to me. They God keeps giving this to me, because bred the bitch again, bred her to a more excessive stud. That moved the litter forward. And I got two puppies, a male and a female. And I mean, the male is better by far. So again, with the dogs. So I want the bitches, but God keeps giving me great dogs. So I'm just going to work with what I got. Oh, and I'll lease more bitches.
This is a question I like to ask because it's interesting to me, and there's different answers because of obvious genetic reasons. What is it? How are the females in the whelping process and birth, and what does the process look for like for you? Do you do AI? Do you do surgical, or do you do natural, or what?
Mm-mm. So I'll SAI in a minute, and I C-section every time. And the reason is really simple. I don't want to be four puppies deep and have a problem and then have to go to the local yokel here, who's a 22-year-old vet that's going to then deal with my litter. To me, it seems that it is more efficient, effective, and prudent to just simply schedule a section.
How are the St. Bernard moms during the whelping process? Are they pretty good, or are they pretty attentive? Or
I mean, you know, like when you section them, they suddenly have puppies and don't know the puppies are there. So there's a little bit of a handover there. A St. Bernard bitch can crush a puppy in a skinny minute. So you got to kind of be on them. But I've been really fortunate. I've had bitches that whelped nicely, that were attentive and friendly with their pups. They roll over on them, but it's just a matter of size. But I've been fortunate with mine.
What's the average litter size these days?
Well, I don't know what the average litter size is, because I see everything from 3 to 17. So I think some of that has to do with the age of the bitch. Some of that has to do with timing, a bunch of different things. I mean, you can do an assessment at 8 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, and pretty much know what you got, but that thing's not going to grow full until. I mean, would you really want to breed a bitch before you saw what you got? Because we're supposed to be breeding phenotype, the best phenotype to the best phenotype. So I guess if you got a bitch, you got what you got. But I mean, I can tell you that you and I worked long and hard to get this bitch, and then I'm not even sure I want to breed her because she doesn't have the phenotype that I'm looking for. You can whelp them over 6 or 7, but it seems like the litter sizes kind of get smaller. So if you're doing, I mean, if you're doing 3 litters on a bitch, then she should be done by the time she's 6 years old. You don't want to go too far out of back to back. And I think, you know, with ours, I mean, they're veterans at 7. So, I mean, ideally you'd like to be done by the time they're 5 or 6.
What's the average lifespan these days for St. Bernard?
I mean, that varies a lot. Okay. So, I mean, because if you get into the higher coefficients of inbreeding, the more inbred dogs, the ones that tend to look better and do in the show ring, tend to live shorter. We have a lifespan achievement award at, I think, 10 years old or 12 years old. It's not unheard of to have a 12-year-old. But I think, you know, if you get them up to 8, 9 years old and they're still ticking, you're pretty happy. They click 10 years old, you're like, hey, that's amazing. 11, you're like, wow. So, yeah. 9, 10, 11. Not that they won't, just, you know, on the average.
In our conversation prior to setting this up, we talked about this and you just kind of mentioned it, and it's something I wanted to talk about a little bit. The coefficiency thing is really interesting to me because certain breeds, mm-hmm. especially since I've talked to a lot of people from the working dog world, they heavily line breed, mm-hmm. and strategically inbreed, mm-hmm. and their coefficiencies, I'm sure, are through the roof. What do those numbers mean to you, and when is it appropriate to go for an outcross?
So what the number, it's not the numbers that necessarily drive the outcross. It's okay. So the coefficient of inbreeding is, you know, how much double up is there in a pedigree, right? And that double up is going to double up on traits, good and bad traits. So it's not just a blind number. It's where is the higher coey and on what dog, and what's the contributing dog that's bringing it. So like if it's a garbage dog in the pedigree that's doubled up, that doesn't help you. If it's a gold mine in the pedigree that's doubled up, that does help you. So it's not as simple as just saying the number. But I would say that in St. Bernards, it's been my observation that once you get north of about a 10% coefficient of inbreeding, there are observable autoimmune issues that crop up. And that tells me that you're pushing the envelope. That doesn't mean that I haven't seen a 19 or a 20 that was a beautiful dog that didn't have autoimmune. So again, that coefficient of inbreeding, or the COE, is another tool in the box. So the same way that I talked about the testing, the health testing being a tool in the box of consideration, the COE is a tool in the box of consideration. It's more of like a marker or an indicator for you to help you understand what you're looking at to try to predict what you're making, right? So it's not like breed a 5, breed a 5, breed a 5, breed a 7. It's not that simple. It's part of the equation.
So if you were the master of the St. Bernard universe, what would you like to see happen in the next 5 or 10 years with the breed?
I would like to see some coordination between the factions in the St. Bernard world. We are, I guess I could try to typify it and say we are East Coast, West Coast split, but it's not that simple. There are sound lines in St. Bernards that by commingling them, you could advance the idea of the diversity that you seek by reducing COE while still maintaining lines, right? So, I mean, an outcross isn't just like, hey, let's grab something random and throw it in here. Ideally, you're taking a line and mixing it with another line for the outcross, not just Jim Bob's dog from around the corner just to say, oh, now I've infused some new genetic material. So, There are programs that don't tend to dance together, and I'd like to see them take the opportunity to do that. I'd like to see somebody cross the Rubicon, so to speak. Probably won't be me, but I'd like to see somebody do that. You know that, and I'd really like to see the St. Bernard Club as a whole, not just the board, not just any particular officer. All of the members, anybody that's interested in these guys, anybody that has a St. Bernard, I would say to them, I would plead with them to drop their prejudices and biases against others within the breed and let everybody do a reset and start over. Because I think sometimes the strife and the problems are because people just happen to crisscross at a particular time in their life. And if you had a chance to reset, I think that would help everybody involved. I know it'd make things a lot better for social activities within the breed. We wouldn't have Hatfield McCoy stuff going on. Not that we do. It's not that bad. But you know what I'm saying. Like in general, I think it would be better if we led with love.
So what are the other co-colors within the standard?
It's always going to be some version of brown. There's brown and mahogany, we call it, because it's different shades of red. But basically, you've got a full mantle, which is going to be, you know, brown all the way down the back. You've got a torn mantle that's going to have patches of white in it. Okay. Oh, and then if you got dark encircled in white, we call that a splash coat. But they're always going to be some version of brown and white, or white and brown. And talking about white factor is a whole other discussion, because they're not supposed to be white and, they're supposed to be brown and, or mahogany and. So like, what's this? Oh, so when they're darker and they've got that, like, kind of looks like black in there, that's what we're calling the mahogany. And then when they're lighter, they might be brown, or rust is one of the choices. So, you know, if they've got a little bit of color in there, you might call them rust. But they all pretty much look the same. It's gonna be, Saint Bernard, close your eyes, think Saint Bernard. That's what they look like.
Is there any recessive gene that throws different colors?
Well, I mean, we do have a white factor thing, right? So tint is a big deal in these dogs. They're meant to have black eyelids and black lips, right? And when there's not a whole lot of that tint in general, you'll find desaturation of the coat as well. So you'll find they'll have patches of pink in the lips, and not as much brown in the coat. And quite frankly, while they will let that slide, I don't think you should. The dog's supposed to be brown and white. You let the white factor creep in there. I think you're fighting. I call it herpes, to be honest with you, because once it's in there, you ain't getting rid of it. So, but they're meant to have that mask, have dark ears, white on the nape of the neck, brown on the back, white tip of the tail, white legs, white feet, you know.
So, like in the Frenchie world, brindle has kind of lost its favor. Is there anything in the Saint Bernard world that's within the standard, but people are trying to not breed towards because it's not winning the show ring?
So the darker colors look better on the dogs, but that white factor drags the color, right? So you'll find people that have these kind of buff colored or sand colored dogs. That's not ideal. You want them dark. But I mean, is there something somebody's not breeding? I mean, like, so you got to figure, like, we're breeding for that type. We're supposed to consider coat color secondary. But do you really want a piebald St. Bernard? I don't. Do you really want a half mask St. Bernard? I don't. They're out there. But I mean, you know, they're supposed to be a full mask. They're supposed to have a blaze. They're supposed to have dark colored ears, ideally black. They're supposed to have white down the nape of the neck. That should trail around one side. Doesn't have to be the full white collar. Those legs better be white. There shouldn't be liver spots on them. They need to have cat feet too. They ought to have proper toes. They need to have hocks of moderate angulation. They need to be, you know, white down the back of the feet. They can have some brown on the knees maybe, but I mean, like, you know, they're supposed to look like a St. Bernard. And I think when you drift from that, it's a problem. Where they get glossy and sexy is when you get into the deeper colors and tones. In fact, if you were to go through and start looking at, you know, St. Bernard's notable St. Bernards, you'll notice that most of the notable St. Bernards carry some kind of significantly dark pigment. So we're not just talking about the black lips. We're talking about the saturation in the coat also having that deep, rich, mahogany, almost black-looking finish to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And dark eyes, for God's sake. Don't no blue eyes. Dark eyes.
Dark. That's how that happens.
Yeah, you know. Time. Yeah, you know. And if we had I saw a discussion on Facebook about that. They were like, "I got a typey dog with a blue eye. Do I breed it?" Yeah, you probably do. You don't want that blue eye, but I mean, you know, you want dark. They got to have dark eyes. They're supposed to be able to see in the snow, right? So the whole reason we're doing this mask and the black eyelids is the same reason that a ball player puts the black on his face. It cuts down on the glare. So if the dog's white and the dog has light colored eyes, it's not going to function in that bright environment the way it's supposed to. Just like if it doesn't have a long enough nose, it can't, and long enough muzzle, it can't humidify the oxygen in that cold environment. The dog should do what it's bred to do.
How do they handle the heat?
So, I mean, it depends on how they're acclimated, right? If the dog, like, I mean, we have a couple of successful kennels in Texas. We've got some in Florida. Obviously, it's warmer down there. But if the dog is used to it and you can keep them in an environment where they're not subject to too much heat, they're fine. Markers are going to be things like you really shouldn't exceed 140 in temperature and humidity combined on the dog. You shouldn't as a human, by the way, either. If the temperature and the humidity equals 140 or above, you cannot convect heat appropriately and you will overheat, human or dog. So 70 degrees, 70% humidity and up, that's a problem. So same thing with these guys. You know, they prefer to have a little bit of cool, and it's really nice if you can get them in the cold in the wintertime, because if you don't have them in the cold, you don't get that nice, thick, dense coat that you know, when you get a St. Bernard, you want to, like, you know, you want to feel that coat and be like, wow. Obviously, if they're climatized to, you know, warm environments, they don't do that as much. You need a lighter coat. So you can. And don't be scared to shave them. It grows back just fine.
Okay.
I'd cross the Rubicon there, too.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Is that sort of a thing, a myth that not to do that?
Or? Well, everybody says don't shave them because you're going to destroy them and stuff like that, but it's not going to hurt anything. You shave them, just make sure you shave them early enough that it grows back before you have them in shows.
Right.
No knots that way either.